You're listening to Exploring Boys Education, a regular podcast produced by IBSC that examines current issues affecting boys, teachers of boys, and boys' schools. I'm Bruce Collins, Director of Member Engagement at IBSC. Over the past year, IBSC brought together leading researchers, practitioners, educators, and school leaders for a series of online programs, each one focused on the boys we teach, the schools we run, and the world in which our boys find themselves. The single idea that runs through more of our sessions this year than any other is connection. The relationship between a boy and himself, between a boy and the people around him, and between the boy and something larger than himself. Many of you know Matt Engler-Colson, Professor of Counseling at California State University Fullerton and a core author of the American Psychological Association's Guidelines for Practice with Boys and Men. He opened IBSC's PD year with a session called Empowering Boys, and he didn't hold back on highlighting the importance of all of our work with boys.
In many ways, the work that I do, the work that you do, the work that IBSC does, it's a fight about life, or at least a long, healthy life, and there's never been a better time to do this work. It's a good time to dig in and kind of fight. And why? Because you've probably noticed that something seems to be shifting right now. I believe it's a movement. It's not a moment. In the United States, a week doesn't go by that there isn't some article in the New York Times about boys and men. We're seeing in the United States that actually some governors are beginning to seriously think about the health of boys and men and beginning to look at policy changes. And that's very exciting for schools. Because if you want to help boys, you got to go where boys are.
Matt's answer to what we are seeing is connection. Not connection as a program or a pastoral add-on, but as the biological and psychological bedrock of male health.
You don't have to sacrifice connection in the pursuit of a high-quality education. And actually, connection will make that education even better. So I'm going to challenge you to stop using the word self-care. The word is actually self-care and community care. They go together. Taking care of yourself doesn't matter if your community is unhealthy. So they are intimately connected. And this is a starting point to start thinking about how your classroom could look different if you model connection as the primary focus.
I love that. Connection over achievement. That is a direct challenge to how schools are publicly measured. But notice that Matt is careful to say you don't have to choose. Connection and academic quality reinforce each other. The evidence he brings is clear. Boys who feel connected perform better, are more resilient, and are better protected against mental health risk. Tom Batty, IBSC's executive director, returned to this theme in his own IBSC Insights session. Drawing on the foundational work by Reichert and Hawley, Tom makes a point we all know well. And while it is easy to say, it's much harder to act on consistently.
Boys tend to elicit the pedagogy they need. So they decide when they're going to tune in. They decide what works for them. And we need to respond to it. Good lessons have a transitive element to them, story, humor, activity. Boys tend to hang their learning. They don't just receive and remember. They hang their learning on things. And the fundamental one is that they're relational learners. And they learn their teachers before they learn their lessons.
As often as we've heard that in IBSC circles, it's not sentiment. It's a finding from decades of research. And it also shows up clearly in Andrew Martin's recent global IBSC study, which surveyed 17,500 boys across our member schools. Andrew is a professor of educational psychology at the University of New South Wales in Australia, and his data points to something powerful about what teachers actually do that moves the needle.
Key part of relational support and emerged was knowing lots about the boys they teach, effortfully and mindfully taking the time to get to know boys, either know them in terms of important information about them academically, but also know them in terms of life outside the classroom itself.
Really knowing students is the trait that separates the exemplary teachers in Andrew's data. This connects directly to what boys need to feel from the adults around them, that we believe in their ability, that we listen, and that we act on what they tell us. When those things are in place, everything else becomes possible. Again, Matt Engler-Colson captures that possibility in two words that he uses carefully, belonging versus mattering. And it's a distinction worth sitting with.
We know that for boys, actually having healthy peer relationships are protective against mental health distress. It improves their health and well-being and improves academic outcomes, really important. On the other side, disconnected boys are at higher risk of tuning out, dropping out, giving up, or becoming problems in the classroom. They feel like dudes do not matter and no one notices or cares about them. So one solution to that, of course, is actually beginning to focus on mattering in the classroom. So imagine if we modeled a school around connection, that became the primary focus. How might that change things for everyone involved? What would that look like? Connection over achievement. And I know in many of the schools that you work in, achievement is important. Parents expect results. That's why they bring their boys to you, right? And actually kind of showing that quality outcome is important. But I will tell you that you don't have to sacrifice connection in the pursuit of a high quality education.
Belonging welcomes boys. Mattering dignifies them. Our schools can do both. And the research tells us that boys who feel they matter, who feel seen as individuals, not just tolerated as part of the cohort, are the ones that thrive. The second theme running through this year's programming is the digital world boys inhabit, not as a problem to be solved, but as a reality to be understood. Several of our sessions this year approach this territory from very different angles, and together they give a picture that is more nuanced than the usual alarm bell headlines. Rourke Wilson, an associate at the Digital Law Company in South Africa and a boys' school alum, opened their session with a framing that is worth carrying into every conversation we have about boys and technology.
I would argue that giving a child access to the internet is comparable to giving them access to a car. You know, when we give kids a driving license, we make sure that they've gone through the learner's permit first and that they've been tested and that they can be trusted to pilot a vehicle without harming themselves or others. And when it comes to things that go wrong online, it can literally have life-ending consequences for some people.
What Rourke makes clear is that it isn't boys who have fundamentally changed. It's the environment they're navigating. And part of what makes it so difficult is that the consequences of getting it wrong are no longer contained. Research psychologist at Imperial College London, Nick Ballou, brought an evidence-grounded perspective to the question of boys and gaming. And one of his most important contributions was to simply separate myth from data.
Are games good for well-being? Absolutely, 100% yes. For social well-being, for identity development, for feeling a sense of growth and of mastery, potentially some of those skills and problem-solving strategies can translate to other parts of life. There are a myriad of ways that games can be good for well-being. Are games bad for well-being? Equally, yes. From everything from toxicity to dark patterns, games designed to get players to do things that aren't in their own best interests, to addiction or problematic use, lots of other ways that games can be bad for well-being as well. And our task as researchers, and eventually your task as practitioners, really, people who are trying to guide younger users in the healthy versus unhealthy play, is knowing when players will experience positive versus negative effects.
Nick's diagnostic question cuts to the heart of whether gaming is a concern. When a boy is feeling low, can he name anything other than gaming that helps? If not, that's the signal to pay attention. Looks maxing, the practice of optimizing physical appearance through deliberate, often obsessive routines, skincare, grooming, gym work, posture correction, even surgery like jaw fillers or bone smashing, was brought to our attention by University of Melbourne researcher Scott Griffiths. In his presentation, Scott took something most of us sense is changing, boys' relationship with how they look, and highlighted how trends are taking hold.
Don't think of looks maxing as an emergent phenomenon that is completely new and there was nothing before it. Think of it as the latest branding, the latest hashtag of a fomenting concern among boys about the way they look and about their physical appearance that has been there for some time and which now, because of social media, is really able to become its own community that you may yourself be completely unaware of. Because if you're on social media, your algorithm is showing you something completely different.
The anxiety boys feel about how they look has existed for a long time. Social media has just given it an infrastructure and an audience of billions. Isaac Rose Berman, a research and policy fellow at the American Institute for Boys and Men, brought sharp insights into another growing online concern. Legal online sports gambling has exploded across the world, and its design built for maximum engagement, maximum emotional investment, and maximum loss disguised as almost winning, is finding its way to younger and younger boys.
I still tend to believe that these conversations are better had earlier, not only because this type of messaging can compound over time, but because in my experience, especially with the degree to which young people are online these days, they are going to see it. It's very rare that when I go to high schools, anybody has not seen gambling advertising. When it comes to middle schools, most of them are familiar. I probably wouldn't do the gambling talk before like 12 or 13, but I think a lot of the more general things about being taken advantage of from a marketing perspective or the probability things can start from a very young age.
Isaac's practical advice is to start with the mathematics. How do these products actually work? And why do they always favor the house? Before getting into the behavioral health conversation. Understanding the mechanics, he says, is protective in a way that warnings alone are not. In essence, what I took away from these conversations and the third emerging theme from this year's IBSCPD events is that boys' schools, when they're working well, are precisely the institutions the current moment demands. This came through in a number of programs throughout the year. One of my favorite programs is our annual IBSC board panel, which this year brought together four heads. David Deeney from St. Mark's School of Texas in the United States, Deborah Barker from St. Kevin's College in Australia, Lester Lulla from Bishop's Preparatory School in South Africa, and Mark Sturgeon from Aylesbury Grammar School in the United Kingdom. They spoke about what boys' schools actually do, not in theory, but in practice. Deborah Barker opened with a challenge that sits at the heart of any values-led institution.
The importance of mission and value is at the forefront of our minds when we lead. I suppose to be authentic leaders and to be an authentic school, we must walk the talk. And so for us, if we talk about kindness, if we talk about integrity, if we talk about compassion and forgiveness, it's where do we see this in the day-to-day of the college? Our mission and our values very much sets the framework for the environment which we create at St. Kevin's, and through policy, through the conversations. And I suppose that becomes the light or the beacon by which we educate our boys, and in many ways in which we provide that environment.
Mark Sturgeon picked up the thread and shared a story that says everything about what belonging in a boys' school can mean.
We have a very well-established house system in the school, which is kind of the DNA of the school. Students come into a class and they're allocated at one of our six houses, and that becomes a family. It's really important that the boys feel that sense of belonging, not just to the school, but their house as well. The tangible impact of that, be it through their tutor group and friendships within their year group or across year groups, we have house assemblies, students coming together in vertical tutor groups as well, 11 to 18 boys all mixing together in an assembly. And the competitions that flow from that, that I'm sure many, many schools have, enable the boys to get engaged at a level at which they feel comfortable. I once gave a talk to the University of the Third Age here in the UK about the history of the school, and a 91-year-old walked up to me and said, "I know all about the school. I went there. How is my house doing?" And that's the first thing all old students of the school will say is, "How is my house getting on?" Because there's that real sense of belonging, camaraderie, that real sense of this is who I am and who I will always be. And that for us is a real strength.
And David Deeney offered the simplest measure of whether a boys' school is doing what it should.
Boys walk onto campus and they should be able to answer the questions positively. If they ask themselves reflectively, "Do you know me? Do you love me? And are you committed to my success?" And you want that for every single boy that walks on campus every day. And it looks different for every boy, as we all know.
Boys' schools don't just happen to be good environments. They're structured around what works for boys. And Tom Batty, again, in his insight session, reinforced something crucial, that strong social relationships are not a byproduct of a good boys' school. They are its central product.
We should be teaching boys that strong social relationships are the single greatest predictor of a long, healthy, and happy life for a man. That's pretty powerful. Now, boys' schools are absolutely perfectly placed to do this. And what I've seen as I travel around, some of the great things that I've seen a UK school researching at the moment well-being in a boarding environment, drilling down on the nature of friendship. In Australia, I've seen a school using survey data, rather than to put people of different minds for debate, but looking to put like-minded boys in groups together to try and foster friendship building. Again, in Australia, I've seen a school using its service program to foster friendship groups away from school through service to others. In South Africa, I've seen, again, similar type of thing, but within the teaching environment, that sealing friendships through intentional grouping of boys on project-based non-competitive work. So when forming groups in the class for project work, actually giving thought to putting it together and realizing that a big part of what you'll be doing in terms of gain is if you can form friendships between the boys who are doing the work together.
Placing boys in the right environment is only part of the work. Sally Ann Huang, High Master of St. Paul's School in the United Kingdom, made the point that the leadership of these environments matters too, and she brought a wide-ranging case for what women specifically bring to the role.
I've heard women in IBSC talk about women in leadership in IBSC schools as having a pioneering mindset. And that kind of comes into that, are you okay with change? Are you okay with challenge? Because there will be, this is new territory, and are you happy to be forging ahead? All the Michael Reichardt stuff, we know that boys like relational learning. We know that they need people who have those skills, and women have those skills in a huge amounts and can also convey them to boys. If we can bring love to the environment, I really love the fact that particularly in North America, people talk about love in a school context. I have to say, I think the culture in England is probably too cynical for us to get away with using that word when we talk about our pupils, but we can talk about care. And I think that those softer skills, that warmth, of course, men can do this too, but it's one of the strengths of women. Here at St. Paul's, we've just, inspired by IBSC colleagues, we've just launched a research centre for the education of boys. I was interviewed by the Sunday Times here a couple of weeks ago. It's the first time I've ever been quoted in a major newspaper in the UK and not been misquoted. But they were really interested because I talked about a few things, but they like the idea of let's not label the boys currently in our schools with toxic masculinity. These boys are good. These boys have done great things and they will do great things. Clearly, if a man were to say that, he might be accused of being defensive, having self-interest. This is a moment for us now that we've always had the he for she, which is very important, but we could now be she for he because we can speak up for other people. It's being an ally. And of course, it doesn't mean that women don't need allies still. Of course, they do. That work's not done. But it is a moment where female leaders in boys' schools can be allies. And this one is interesting because clearly you can do all of these things and not be a mother. But the idea that you can be a mother figure, because usually the first authority figure, not always for very good reasons, but usually the first authority figure that a boy has in his life is probably his mother. So the association with the mother figure is something where there's starting to be some research. And there's a research paper that's on female heads of boys' schools in Ghana. And again, they don't necessarily have to be mothers themselves, but they do talk about themselves very profoundly as the mother of the school. And that with that sense that you are the mother of the school comes an inherent respect. And again, it's not necessarily the same as being a biological mother, but the response boys have to that.
Sally Ann's point that the current moment in boys' education may be precisely the kind of disruptive context that opens the door to leadership that looks different is insightful. A past student of mine, and this was a real pleasure to host, Callan Moore, who is also a senior English teacher at St. Albans College in South Africa and a PhD candidate at the University of Pretoria, shared his master's research on agreeable disagreement with us and gave us the FRED framework, which provides language for managing difficult conversations about hot topics and controversial issues in our schools and in our classrooms.
FRED stands for Freedom of Speech, Respect, Equality, and Diversity. And at the beginning of each year, I go through the FRED framework with my classes. FRED sits, like I said, in our class, and often at the end of a discussion that is particularly controversial in nature, in which things have become heated, in which we've perhaps made one or two missteps, I'll go back to FRED and I'll ask, would FRED agree with our conversation? Where do you think FRED might be upset? What do you think FRED would be happy with in regards to our conversation? So usually I would start with a discussion around freedom of speech and ask learners, well, what does freedom of speech mean? Why is the freedom of speech important? And then we'll move on to limitations of freedom of speech and how it links to the right to human dignity, the R in FRED. I find equality quite difficult to navigate with my boys, especially in a privileged environment, what it means that equality doesn't necessarily mean fairness, and it's important. And finally, D, diversity in Fred, the idea that diversity is a strength is a big part of the rules of our classroom. So that's Fred. Fred allows us to reach out and engage in controversial topics. It allows us to take risks. It allows us to navigate complex and controversial content that we might come across in the curriculum.
Callan's Fred framework, freedom of speech, respect, equality, and diversity, gives teachers a practical scaffold for creating the conditions in which boys can say difficult things, hear difficult things, and emerge from the conversation with stronger values rather than more entrenched fears. Front of everyone's mind these days is AI, particularly its impact on boys and boys' schools and education in general. It was a pleasure to host Rebecca Winthrop, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution. Rebecca brought together two bodies of research for us, one on student engagement and one on AI, and highlighted the connection between them. And that connection is both hopeful and sobering.
People are not necessarily just accessing generative AI in these narrow, intentional ways. And again, we would define narrow as vetted content, embedded in good quality pedagogy, probably, though not always, mediated by a teacher, a mentor, a coach of some sort, and used very intentionally. Wide AI use can really diminish learning. And when we mean by wide AI use is sort of ongoing, unscaffolded, open-ended discussions that students are having with AI chatbots or AI friends or companions that aren't designed for kids and aren't designed for learning. And we found a lot of risks. Cognitive stunting, you may have heard the word cognitive offloading. I actually think cognitive stunting is better. I'm worried that kids are going to not have the effortful learning experiences they need to cognitively develop their brains. A lot of people outside of the education space say, oh, it's like the calculator. It is not like the calculator. The calculator automated a sliver of arithmetic and other things, but didn't do all math or English or physics or chemistry or biology or history or social studies or poetry or do music or do art history or take the SAT for you or give relationship advice or guilt trip you if you don't use it, which AI friends do. We do know that's undermining social and emotional development. 1 out of 3 teens say, in the US, say they prefer talking to an AI friend than another human being. One of the things we are seeing, and I am quite worried about, is the reduction in trusting relationships. I'm not sure if you guys see it in your schools, but you know, it's not everywhere. It's not every kid. It's not every school. But certainly half of the teachers in the U.S. reported not trusting the authenticity of their kids' work. Kids also reported feeling like when teachers used AI, it was a signal of not caring about them and not being professional and good at their job. If you don't have trusting relationships, it sort of hurts the core of the instructional process, which is the interaction between content educator learners and, of course, supports by parents. The thing I most worry about is so many kids said they felt like they couldn't start their work without it. They were dependent on it. They didn't see the point of learning in school because the machine can do all this stuff perfectly well. And I would say that a lot of this wide AI use is outside of school. We do, as the education community, have to think about how we interact and build partnerships with families and out of school providers.
Rebecca's concern is not that AI will make boys lazy. It's that it will undermine the kind of relationships, the kinds of authentic struggle, the kinds of genuine thinking that make education transformative. And we all know that relational work starts young. And we're grateful for all of those in elementary schools who are doing the best for boys. Faith Hunter, who is the director of the lower school at the Buckley School in New York, and her colleagues, Dina Herity, Brandon Lazarchek and Catherine Rothstein, brought a session full of practical energy about what it means to design an environment genuinely built for how boys learn.
There's some basic research about how we learn best, and that is listening passively is the least effective and impactful means by which we learn. So with my administrator hat on, when I'm thinking about PD for my teachers, for my brand new teachers, and I'm thinking about PD for the teachers that have been with us for a long time that I want to repeat again and again, we have one principle, and it is boys should not be listening passively for more minutes than years they are alive. So yes, that means at 6 years old, 6 minutes on the rug, unless they're really doing something. At 9 years old, 9 minutes on the rug, unless they're really doing something.
Simple, practical, and grounded in how boys' brains actually work. But it's only the headline. What the rest of the team showed us is how that principle gets built into curriculum year on year until it becomes something a boy carries with him.
In the early childhood years, we always begin the year with meaningful and carefully selected SEL activities. These activities are focused around and designed to help the boys strengthen their relationships among each other, of course, and help them learn about themselves. But also, they help me as the teacher better understand my students. This helps me as the teacher identify early strengths and weaknesses of the class, but also helps me inform my instruction and better engage my students as the year goes on. Strengthening the boys' emotional vocabulary was really important, as we all know. So identifying their own feelings, but also understanding the feelings of others and being able to relate to others in a deeper level. We know the boys need movement breaks, and we do this in a variety of ways, but we also like to think about how to kind of sneak in movement breaks.
When I reflect on whether or not a lesson is engaging for our boys, there's usually three considerations. First, are boys' conversations focused or are they drifting off topic? Second, are boys understanding and applying the intended concepts and strategies? And then third, are they getting enough meaningful practice to master concepts and then build fluency with strategies and skills? Because we explicitly teach these speaking and listening skills in class one, by class two, our boys are really able to collaborate productively in partnerships. They have communication skills, collaboration skills. They're developing the ability to regulate their emotions. We also need our boys developing grit and growth mindset and perseverance. So as frequently as possible, we try to give boys the opportunity to tackle non-routine problems with a partner so that they can start to develop grit, growth mindset, and perseverance, and then apply it later on independently.
Once boys reach class four, we're really focused on curating this really meaningful and final culminating year to lower school, where there's a central focus on the social-emotional learning pieces, differentiated instruction, and also this deep knowledge of each boy and how that really can fuel rigorous learning opportunities across the grade level and across their time here at Buckley.
Rolling out initiatives that stick and build upon one another is such an important, intentional, and deliberate practice. Like, the rollout matters. And the boys are able in class four to do what they're able to do in class four because how aligned and systematically those pieces are developed from beginners in our school, which is kindergarten, through class four.
Like many of our schools do, Faith and her team's education of boys is directly grounded in how boys' brains work, built on evidence. And it reminds me again that being a boys' school by choice enables us to be schools built for boys. Three themes, 17 voices, one consistent direction of travel. Boys thrive when they feel known, when they feel they matter, and when the adults around them model the relational honesty they're asking boys to embrace. Boys are navigating a digital world that is genuinely novel, not just in its scale, but in the speed and precision with which it targets them. And they need schools that help them build the critical awareness, the internal resources, and the real-world connections that make that navigation possible. And boys' schools, when they're functioning at their best, with intentional culture, strong pedagogy, courageous conversations, and leaders who are willing to model what they ask of students, are exactly the institutions the current moment needs. If any of the insights from this episode have resonated with you, we encourage you and invite you to join an IBSC online program in our next PD year. We have some exciting offerings lined up. In addition, consider exploring some of our Ideas Lab programs, consider joining an IBSC online class, and access the full library of this podcast, Exploring Boys Education. For now, though, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, keep on championing boys' education.